Well, we're beginning a brand new series for the summer. Our summer series, we're going to talk about one thing all summer. We're going to talk about faith all summer. It's not going to stop, and maybe you're thinking, how do you talk about one subject all summer? I'm not sure, but we're going to try, and we're going to just talk about faith all summer, and part of it is because half of you leave for half of the summer. So we're just going to repeat ourselves a lot, and by the end of the summer, you'll get everything. And those of you that are here all summer, I just have two words for you. I'm sorry. So come every week, we'll be talking about different things. You know, if you've been in church, or probably if you've been a Christian any length of time, we're going to look at faith, and probably you already have an idea of what we're going to look at. We're going to look at some characters from past, ages ago, you know, years and years ago, and look at the different aspects of how faith played out in their lives. And so although we're talking about faith, it's going to be kind of different nuances and different ways that faith plays out in their lives, and also how faith plays out in our own lives as well. And so it's going to be a whole summer series on faith, looking at Hebrews chapter 11. And there's a whole bunch of characters, and maybe you're thinking, I've never even heard of Hebrews 11 and these heroes of faith, or the hall of faith, we often call them. I'm sure you've heard of some of the characters. We're going to talk about guys like Abraham and Moses and Noah, and I'm sure at some point you've heard those because there's been movies made of some of these folks and so on. So every Sunday we're going to look at different characters of faith, looking at the characters mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11. Now, faith is an interesting word. Probably if I was to sit down with you, or you sat down with me and said, what is faith? Probably most of us could kind of stumble through some sort of definition of faith. But it's, you know, on the one hand, we kind of understand it. On the other hand, there's some things that are kind of confusing about faith. But here's how Oxford Dictionary defines faith. It says, complete trust or confidence in someone or something. That's faith. Complete trust or complete confidence in someone or something. That trust and confidence. You know, often we use the word faith in terms of, you know, sports teams, or if you're on a team, or even for yourself, you just say, you just need to have faith in yourself. You need to have that confidence. You just need to believe in yourself. And if you're a team, maybe you say, you know, we accomplished our goal of winning the championship because of the belief system we had, the faith we had in ourselves. And if you've got confidence, if you've got faith, I mean, you can just accomplish things maybe you didn't know you could accomplish. You play bigger, you play stronger, you play faster because of that faith and that confidence that you have in yourself. And so faith is something that isn't just a religious term. It's something we talk about and we live out in all of life. In fact, this morning, if you were new to church and you sat down on the chair, you exercise faith. Every time you go to the doctor's office, or you go to the lawyer's office, and you sit down in a chair, you're exercising faith. You believe and you have confidence that thing's going to hold you up. And sometime, you know, maybe you'll sit down and it won't hold you up and you'll look like the fool. But we exercise faith in all sorts and areas of life, both with people, confidence in someone, but also in things, confidence in something. But obviously, faith is also religious, and we've talked about, you know, faith as a religious thing very, very often, and Oxford Dictionary also defines it in the religious sense this way. It is, strong belief in the doctrines of a religion, and then this is where it kind of goes sideways for some of you. Based on spiritual conviction rather than proof, right? Based on spiritual conviction rather than any kind of proof. And for many of you, you know, this is where religion kind of gets a bad rap, because it's just kind of like, you can't really know. That's why you have faith. That's why religion is so, you know, faith in religion is just, who would have that kind of faith? It's blind faith, because you can't really know. There's no proof. And so you just have this kind of blind faith, and many outside of, you know, Christianity may look at Christianity and say, you know, if it helps you sleep at night, keep believing. And hold on to that feeling, right? However you want to put it. You know, it's just this feeling of, I hope it's true, and hope is kind of like, cross your fingers, I'm not sure. But this is often where religion or religious faith gets a bit of a bad rap, because, you know, how can you even know, but you just keep believing because it helps you sleep at night. And so, there's this idea of blind faith. And here's one of the true aspects of faith. Faith always takes a leap. In any kind of faith, there's always a step where there's a leap of faith. And this is where, you know, in religious circles, again, and faith, speaking of it in religious terms, often gets a bad rap because it's kind of like, you don't know, there's no proof, but you're taking this kind of leap of faith. But leaps of faith are in any kind of faith you exercise, and we all exercise faith, whether you're a Christian or you're a Muslim or you're a Mormon or you're, you know, believe in Buddha, or whoever it is, whatever you believe, there's always leaps of faith, and including even if you're not a believer in any religion at all. You know, for example, in business, there's leaps of faith. Right? I mean, if you're a business owner, at some point you say, you know, I think it's time to expand the business. And at some point you say, I believe, I have faith that we can accomplish this growth. But at some point you take a step, you take a leap of faith. Because here's what's true, you cannot determine the future. And so at some point you say, I think we're gonna buy the extra store, we're gonna expand our inventory, we're gonna do this. But you know, we've done our research. But at some point, there's still a leap, there's still a step, because you can't really know for certain. And so that we do our research and our homework, and you should, if you're taking any step of faith, you should see what evidence is there that this is true and this will succeed. We also take leaps of faith in relationships. You know, in my marriage with Mandy, I take a step of faith that I've taken many steps of faith that she's going to remain faithful to me. I believe that she's going to stay faithful to me. In fact, before we were married, I believed that she would stay faithful to me, and I took steps of faith believing she would stay faithful to me. And when I married her, that was a step of faith that for the next, you know, until her last breath, she's going to stay faithful to me. There was a step, a leap of faith. Now, it wasn't completely blind, though, because I'm not stupid. And so there's things that I did along the way as we were dating. I kind of watched her. You know, if we were dating and she's all of a sudden, you know, going on dates with other guys or, you know, getting physical with other guys, at some point I would have said, you're done, we're done, something's done, but we're not going to continue. I've lost my faith in you. So faith is built on something, isn't it? And now, I mean, there's so much faith in our relationship. She can go to Calgary, she can do shopping, and I trust that she is not going and finding other men in Calgary because of faith that I have in her. But it's faith built on something. It's built on a past. And here's the interesting thing regarding relationships. Does my faith in Mandy make her faithful? Because I believe, so now she is? No. She is faithful. And because of her faithfulness, I have faith in her. And the same is true of God. It doesn't matter how much you believe in God. You cannot bring him into existence. You can't make him be something he's not. You can't make him true. But because of his faithfulness, we believe. And so there's this aspect of every kind of faith has some step. It has a leap, you could say, both in religious and secular environments. But we have faith, and you sit down on that chair because of the faithfulness of the chair. We believe in God because of the faithfulness, because of how he's proved himself in the past. Here's how the writer of Hebrews defines faith. And this isn't, when he was writing this, he wasn't necessarily specifically thinking in religious terms. He was just saying, generally, here's an aspect of how we understand what faith is. And he says this, faith is the confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is faith. He says, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we don't yet see. Again, this could apply in business, right? Faith, taking that step. It's confidence in what I hope the business will grow, right? And assurance of what I don't see. That's faith. And, you know, a lot of times we define faith in subjective terms. It's this feeling, I just have this confidence. And when we say, I just don't have faith, often what we mean is, I don't feel faith. And those two words that he puts in here, confidence and assurance, they can be translated from the Greek into English in two different ways. Both words, actually. And there's lots of debate scholars have about how these words should be, how they should be defined. Because one is subjective, confidence and assurance. The other way it can be defined is, confidence could be defined as it's the substance or the reality, which is objective. It's the substance or reality, the essence of what we hope for, and assurance could be defined as the evidence or proof of what we don't yet see. And so one way defined to kind of subjectively this feeling, which is true, faith and confidence is kind of this feeling, but in Scripture, in our faith as Christians, it's more than just a feeling. There is evidence and proof, and our hope is more than just a cross your fingers and hope that it happens. It is a sure hope, and our faith is sure as well. You know, often I've said this before regarding faith, the object and action of faith are more important than the amount you possess. You know, often we say, man, I don't have a lot of faith. And what we mean by that is subjectively, we don't feel like we have a lot of faith. And yet what's more important when it comes to faith, and we're going to see this all through Hebrews chapter 11, is it's not about how you feel or how much you think you have, but the place you put your faith and how you act on it are much, much, much more important. You know, the other thing we see about this definition of faith is that faith and hope are tightly tied together, very closely tied together. And here's how I've often, here's how I kind of process their connection. Hope is this destination we want to get to. Hope is this. I hope you know the weather is good, or I hope this event occurs in my life, or I have this experience. Hope is this destination that we hope that we desire. Faith are the legs that get us there. Faith are the legs that get us there. You know, we hope for this. Faith is what keeps us on the journey, on the path to getting to that destination. So faith and hope in the Christian circle are not just this close your eyes and take a leap and trust God. You don't really know. There's no proof. But there is evidence. And here's what I want to say about our faith as Christians is our faith in God does not make him true. God's proven past gives us faith. God's proven past gives us faith. Our faith in God doesn't make him true. You can't believe God into existence or believe him into something. He already is, and we believe because of what he's done in the past. And as we go through Hebrews chapter 11, what we're going to see over and over and over again is that God has been faithful. And the writer of Hebrews chapter 11, the reason he writes this is because the people he's writing to are in the midst of extreme persecution and suffering. And here's what is a faith killer every time, and this is probably true in your life, a faith killer for all of us is trial and suffering and pain. And I bet if you look back at your life and you look at the times when you've struggled with faith, if you're a follower of Jesus, I bet somehow it interacts with some pain or some trial or some suffering, some difficulty in your life that makes you say, I don't know if I can believe. I don't know if I can believe. My faith has taken a hit. And so as the writer of Hebrews is writing, he says, you know, faith is the confidence in what we hope for and the assurance of what we don't yet see. He writes that to a group of people who in their current situation didn't see the hope that they were hoping for. They were going through pain and suffering. And so he writes this letter of all these characters of faith to encourage them and say, listen, we have a faithful God. So don't let go of your faith. Here's what he says just before Hebrews 11. He writes about their pain and their suffering. He says this, remember those early days after you had received the light when you endured in a great conflict full of suffering. Now, probably historically, this may have referred to the suffering the Christians endured under Emperor Nero around 60 AD to 70 AD. Or maybe it was even later, some of the suffering they experienced, great suffering under Emperor Domitian, and that was around the early 90s. But somewhere along the line, these Christians had endured great, great suffering. And he says, remember how you stood in that suffering. He goes on, sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times, you weren't the ones persecuted. You stood by. You stood by others. Side by side with those who were so treated. And so you suffered and you stood by those who suffered, but you had an attitude. Remember how you suffered, and maybe you're suffering again, but you had an attitude at that time. He says, you suffered along with those in prison, and get this, and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property. Now we read this and we think, these people were crazy. I would never do that. Who would do that? I mean, who would endure the confiscation of property, the plundering of their own stuff with joy? Nobody does that. And you know, maybe some of us could be so, you know, pious and good to accept graciously the plundering of our stuff, but to accept it with joy? I mean, no one does this, right? Well, I'll tell you who does this. You do this. I do this. All of us would do this if we knew what they knew. And that's what the writer says next. You endured this with suffering, this confiscation of property, not because you're just weird, but because you knew of something better. And he says, because you knew that you yourselves had a better and lasting possessions. In essence, he says, you knew that you had hope, that your destination, your possessions, what you had, are better than what you currently have. You know, in the letter of the Hebrews, building up to this point, and he's writing to these people that are suffering, going through great pain and persecution. The entire letter, if you read it, it talks about, really, it's about the superiority of Jesus. So, you know, he's like, you guys are suffering. Let me tell you about this. It will help you with your suffering. And then he spends 11 chapters speaking about the superiority of Jesus. You know what you used to have in Moses? You know what God did with the law? You know what we had with the Sabbath before? In Jesus, it's all even better. We have something even more in Christ. So much so, and he goes on, he says, you know, we had the sacrificial system, but in Jesus, our sins have been paid for once and for all. There's no more sacrifices needed. Jesus is superior, and as you suffer, you need to understand what you have in Jesus. It's superior. And so they, you know, in essence, they were looking at what they had in front of them, their possessions, and with joy they accepted the confiscation of their possessions because they knew in their hope they had something better, and that was Jesus Christ himself. Who would do this? Well, you and I would do this. In fact, we do this all the time. We let go of lessers because we have something greater, even if we don't have it yet. You know, for example, if you could eat McDonald's and fill yourself with McDonald's because you're just so hungry and you think, I'm just so hungry, I'm going to eat McDonald's. But you knew in 1 hour from now, we're going to the keg. You would let go of the lesser for the greater, wouldn't you? Not because you already have it. You have hope. And your faith that you're actually going to eat at the keg are the legs that would get you to your destination, even though you're starving hungry. And you could eat McDonald's, but your hope in a better destination will get you there through faith. And that's what he's writing. He says, listen, you've already lived this out. You suffered. And there was a season in your life where you let go of your property, and it was with joy, not because you're crazy, but because you knew you had something better, and your hope of Jesus let you hold on to that, and you walk through that suffering by faith. And now he says, don't throw away your confidence. You suffered. You've done this before. And now it's like, again, and it's like they're just willing, they're almost to the point, because suffering, it always, it's a faith killer. It's like they just need this encouragement. Hold on to the faith you have. You have hope. Hold on to the faith that will get you to your hope. Don't let go. Don't throw away your confidence that Jesus is your reward. It will be richly rewarded. You need, he says, you need to persevere. Again, don't let go of faith. So that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. And then he quotes Habakkuk, an Old Testament prophet, and says this, for in a little while he who is coming will come and will not delay. In essence, he says, listen, God is faithful. God is faithful. The one who is coming, he is coming. He is not going to delay. I know it feels like, Jesus, you're taking so stinking long because you were supposed to come back and you haven't come back, and we're going through this suffering, and you're just like, I don't know if I can hang on to faith anymore. He says, no, God is faithful. God is faithful. So, hold on to faith. And that's what he says next. And he says, but my righteous one will live by faith. God is faithful. He's coming. He will not delay. My righteous one will live by faith. Hold on to faith. And I take no pleasure in the one who shrinks back, but we do not belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved, because our hope is in Jesus, our salvation, and we receive that salvation through faith, the hands, the feet that get us to our hope. You know, I think what the author would love to tell us is this. Faith allows us to walk in the hope we have even when our current situation is not hopeful. You know, we have this hope. We have this destination. This God, you said we're going to be saved. God, you said that we're going to be raised back to life. Faith allows us to walk in our hope when our current situation is not hopeful at all. That's what faith does. And the writer says, listen, hold on to your faith. You are not of those who shrink back. You're of those who hold on to the hope you have by faith. And you and we are those who are saved. We are those who are saved. So he says, very next verse. Now this is faith. This is faith. It's confidence. It's confidence. It's the reality, the essence, the substance. It's the confidence of what we hope for. And the assurance, the proof, the evidence of what we don't yet see. And then he goes on and he says, this right here is what the ancients were commended for. And then we dive into these characters. And he lists all these characters and says, let go of your faith. Hold on to the hope you have. Hold on through faith. Because look what God has done in the past. And he starts listing characters, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Noah and Moses and Enoch and Abel and all these people. We're going to dive into those people. But here's what he does next. He does something very interesting. Before he dives into them, he says, you know, we've all exercised this definition of faith. As Christians, we've all exercised it. And so every character, he says, by faith, Noah, by faith, Enoch, by faith, Moses, by faith, Isaac. But first he says, by faith, we. You and I. And he says this, by faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen, which is the universe, the earth, we all see it, what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, we as Christians, we understand that God formed the seen, known, visible universe by what was not seen. And this may be for you if you're not a Christian yet, or maybe you're a Christian, you say, that's where I get lost. The Genesis account of creation, right? I mean, God spoke and the universe came into existence. I mean, that takes so much faith. How can we have that kind of faith? Well, faith is a confidence in what we hope for, the assurance or the evidence of what we don't yet, what we don't see. And how can we believe that? I mean, I haven't seen that happen. How can we believe that? Maybe for you, that's where you know your faith is just kind of like thrown out because you think that's just so blind. I have to believe that. Well, let me just point out this regarding the origins of the universe. No matter what position you take on the origins of the universe, it takes faith. Blind faith. A leap of faith. In fact, I would suggest that the Christian worldview that God spoke the universe into existence has the most evidence, is the least blind form of faith that we have. Here's what in the documentary Expelled, Ben Stein interviewed some leading scientists and philosophers of our world today with the question that has puzzled philosophers and scientists forever. And that is the origins of the universe. How did it all start? And you know, you say it started with an atom or it started with a cell. But the question always comes, well, where did that come from? At some point, something had to start it. So where did the start come from? Well, here's some of the theories that are out there. Philosopher and popular Darwinist Michael Ruse suggested this theory when asked about the origins of life. And he said this. He proposed that the theory that life was seeded on the earth. Meaning this. Aliens did it. So we went from science to science fiction. True, he wasn't kidding. Nobel Prize winner and molecular biologist Francis Crick, when faced with the question and dilemma of the origins of life, proposed this theory. Or one popular theory, sorry, this is with David Roos. The last one was David Roos. I mixed that up, sorry. Last one was David Roos, and he said this. A popular theory is that it might have started off on the backs of crystals. So we have crystals, and we have aliens did it, but the question is still comes, well, where did those come from? What started it? How did you get to any kind of organic life? Many scientists today believe that life started with a single cell. But here's the thing about that understanding, and Darwin was the one who kind of proposed that. It started with a cell, and then that expanded and expanded and formed into more complex forms of life. But here's what Darwin's understanding of cell and our understanding of cell is just very, very different. In the documentary, one scientist was asked regarding the complexity of the cell. And he said, what was Darwin's idea of the cell known, and what is our idea of the cell, of what we know from science today, and how are they different? And so he was asked, if Darwin thought the cell was a Buick vehicle, what's our understanding of the cell today? And the scientist said this, he said, it's a galaxy. Our understanding of the cell is just so expansive. Darwin had no idea. He could have never imagined all that is included in the cell. You know, the likelihood that all of life began from this one cell is just so complex and so near impossible. In fact, Dr. Walter Bradley said this. He said, the simplest forms of life require 250 proteins just to function, which he says it's inconceivable that 250 proteins would form themselves so that they could expand into more complex forms of life. It's inconceivable. And then molecular biologist Doug Axe says this. He says, not only is it inconceivable, it's highly improbable. And then he says this, it's like one in a trillion, 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 trillion chance. Now that's a lot of trillions, and I can't really think that well about that. So I thought, I'm going to figure out what is the probability of this. And so I went to the calculator site.com. And they kind of show you what a trillion is, just so you have an idea of what a trillion is. Now, if you took a million $100 bills and stacked them on each other, they would reach to about the height of the back of your chair, 3 feet. If you had $100 bills and you stacked them, that would be about how much, how high it would go. Now, a billion would be $100 bills stacked on each other. A billion of them would be higher than the tallest building we have on the earth right now, which is the Burj Khalifa. So that's a billion. A trillion, just so you have to understand how massive trillion is, would be like taking $100 bills, stacking them on each other, and they would reach higher than the space station, which is almost 250 miles, 400 kilometers high. It would be over 1,000 kilometers in height. That's a trillion. That is 10 times the height of a plane that flies in the air. And so this scientist says, you know, the idea that these proteins just kind of formed themselves and then grew, and we have the idea of evolution, they just happened on their own. He says, it's like one in not a trillion, which would be that height, one in a trillion, 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 which is a scientist's way. I did all of that just to share this with you. It's a scientist's way of saying it's impossible. Without saying it's impossible, because they're smarter than that. I would just say it's impossible, but they, you know, do it this way. Which is this, to believe any idea about the origins of life is a step of faith. In fact, to believe it was, you know, came to us on the backs of crystals, or that aliens seeded it on the earth, I would say that's more blind. That is more blind. That is a greater leap of the unknown than to say there is a God. And we have evidence after evidence after evidence that points to the impossibility that it just happened. And the probability, we can't prove it, but the probability, the evidence that points to a God, a creator, who did it all. Now, why would the writer of Hebrews, before he says the ancients were commended for their faith and lists all their faith, start with this? That we all have exercised faith, the unseen, and we believe it to be true, and he goes to creation. Why would he start with this? Start with this common denominator of faith that all Christians believe. I think it's because you're suffering. Your faith has taken a hit. But here's what's true. There is a creator, a God who loves you, a God who's faithful. And we see it in creation. He put all these things together, and whatever you're facing right now that is hitting your faith, if he put it all together, he has control of what comes next as well. And now I'm going to list for you all the ways he's been faithful, the writer of Hebrews would say. Because faith allows us to walk in the hope we have, even when our current situation doesn't seem all that hopeful. When difficulties and doubts and trials come and batter your faith, you have a God who's faithful. You have a God who's faithful. Not blind faith, not stupid faith, not foolish faith. Faith in a faithful, faithful God. Our faith doesn't make God true. No amount of believing it or feeling like you believe in God makes him true. God's faithful past is what gives us faith. So I want to ask you, believer in Jesus or not a believer in Jesus, still wondering if you want to put your faith in Jesus, what's hammering your faith right now? Because we all experience the battering of our faith. And often, the writer of Hebrews would say this, often it's because of some difficulty or trial or pain or doubt or question that just keeps hammering our faith. And I would encourage you, come back for this series each week and say, how have you been faithful? But he starts with creation. God put it all together. He holds it and he holds you. He holds your situation. He holds your pain. He holds that thing that's keeping you from stepping out and saying, God, I will trust you. And maybe you don't even feel it yet, but as I said earlier, our faith, the action of faith is more important than the amount you possess. And the object of your faith is more important than the amount you feel. So I would encourage you, put your faith in a faithful, faithful God. We're going to close with communion, and I think this is really fitting for the start of this series. You know, when you talk about the faithfulness of God, as we take this juice, which represents the blood of Jesus, which was spilled and shed for us, as we take this bread, which is the body of Christ, which was broken for us, it is the ultimate pinnacle, the picture of God's faithfulness to us. That God faithfully loves you. And whether you believe him or believe in him or not doesn't change his character. He loves you. And even though you're going through whatever it is that's battering your faith and saying, I don't know if I can believe, as we take communion, I want you to think of that moment when God sent his son Jesus and he proved his faithful love for you so that you could place your faith in him.